most people believe in what we call the field of intelligence. And quite a number believe that that field is called by me God. But that I don't mean God, I only mean the field. Now, how many people here would dare to subscribe to this statement? That when I use the word God, I don't mean an intelligent personal being, but a universal power which governs the universe, created the universe, that is not personal and is simply called God, as a shorthand, instead of using the rather longer term, universal creative power. How many think I mean that? Yes? Why do I admit personal? I said a number of people believe that I use the word God for an impersonal, creative, universal power. I'm going to say that I don't exclude the word person from it at all. But I know a lot of people think that I do, and I want to discuss this in fairly small detail to show really what we're talking about. Today we're in a better position than we were in the days of Thomas Aquinas and various other theologians and thinkers who tried to prove the existence of God by various arguments based on logic. Today we have another way of doing the same thing. And it arises because through the growth of physical science, we have become really aware of the fact that matter is energy. Matter is energy. Let's take an example from William Blake. William Blake said, really the purpose of life is delight. Delight. Enjoyment in the body. And energy is of the body, he said. Energy is of the body, and you are to delight in the body, because from the body comes energy. Well, that was fine in his day, because there was not the scientific proof that matter, that is to say body, is itself energy. So we can take what William Blake meant, energy is of the body, and turn it over and say the body is of energy. Let's accept that our physical body is known to be demonstrably energy. Now we're going to keep that concept in the mind. The body is energy. And the body is that through which we experience thoughts, feelings, impulses of will, desires, wishes, wants. And all these are mysteriously in for each of us what we call the body. But the body is energy. Keep that in mind a moment, and we'll then start to consider the nature of a dualism. Now, in philosophy, there have been dualists, and there have been monists and pluralists. That is to say, there have been men who have believed that if we analyze reality very, very carefully, we will come to the conclusion that the ultimate reality is one. We call those thinkers monists. There is one fundamental cause. And then we have another group called the dualists and say, no, if we say there is one fundamental cause, we have a difficulty, because manifestly in the world there are good things and evil things. And if there is only one thing as basic, that one thing must be the cause of the evil as well as the good. And they would look in the Old Testament, and they would find the God there described saying, am I not he who gives good and gives evil? And the same thing in Islam, God, Allah, is credited with sending evil as well as good. So the monist has to say, good and evil are from the same source. And that's a bit of a puzzle to human beings on earth who say disease is an evil and God is good, therefore how could that good God be the source of the evil, the disease, the killing thing, the painful thing. So they say, well, let us not believe that the evil is from God, and then we have to account for the presence of the evil, and we will invent a philosophy called dualism, and we will say the fundamentals of the world are two, not one. One is a good principle and one is a bad principle, an evil principle. In so-called Persian dualism, we have a good principle and a bad principle. The good principle is intelligence, is working for proper creative purposes, and the bad principle is disintegration, corruption and death. And these two are not related together on a prior unific base. Let's think about this very carefully. We know there is disease and we call it evil. We don't think to ourselves, how about our life possibly being lived in such a way, wrongly, that disease is an automatic result of and indicator of the fact that we are living in the wrong way. In which case, then the disease would not be an evil. It would be a very good warning, like a pain that you get if you bang your bone. The bone is hurt and it wants to rest while it recovers. It sends a message of pain, and you don't like the pain, and you would say the pain is bad. But in fact, if you hadn't got the pain, you'd carry on beating your bones until they fell to pieces. In which case, the disease, the pain, would be a message to tell you, change your lifestyle. Now we have a Maoist view that says the good and the evil come from the same source. We have a dualistic view that says that the principle of good is quite separate from the principle of evil. And we have a pluralistic one that says there aren't just one or two ultimates, but there are an infinite number of ultimates, each one a monad, each one in its own right, and the sort of general scramble between them constitutes reality. Let's examine the nature of the dualism. If two principles existed and they were totally unlike each other, being totally unlike, they could not interact. Let's be quite sure about this. Now, if any of you have any ideas to criticize this statement, will you please let us have them? If there were two ultimate principles, and these principles were mutually exclusive, that is, they had nothing whatever in them of the other one, so you'd have A there and B there, in A there is no B, and in B there is no A. If they are totally dissimilar, they cannot interact. Can we first see the logic of that? And then we'll move forward. If they are totally dissimilar, they cannot interact. Any dissenters? Are there any here who would say, I can imagine a way in which two totally dissimilars could interact? Are there any such persons here? Are there any brave hands to show? Yes? Energy. Are they supposed to have energy, both of them? Wouldn't that make it that they have something in common? Yeah. Namely energy. In which case energy would be the ultimate and not this dualism. Yes? Yeah? Then what happens to your objection? It's not a dualism. You've fallen back into a monism of energy. And that's very, very much like the position in modern science. They're really energetic, monistic thinkers. They say all is energy, and this energy appears on the one hand as good and health, and on the other hand as bad and disease. But energy as basic is not so dualism, is it? So first we have to be quite sure that if there were an ultimate dualism, there could not be an interrelation of function between the two absolutely discrete aspects. Is that so? We've had one objection. Have we any more?
But when it's formed pieces.
No.
Pardon? Have we talked about energy?
Not at this moment, we are. At the moment, we're busy demolishing dualism. We haven't even defined energy yet. We've just said that if it is there, whatever it means, the dualism collapses. Right. So now we have a position in which we are forced to say either a monism is true or there is another solution. Another solution could be pluralism. That's the idea that whatever it is, each thing is itself eternally separate. That's a monadic theory, a pluralistic monadism. Each being is himself eternally what he is, and in no way is influenced by any other being. Leibniz was a great exponent of this in his monadology, and he would say, all the entities in the universe are separate from each other. He even went so far as to say they are windowless. There is no communication. And the apparent relations of beings, in that view, are not real at all. They are appearances. They are accidents. They are non-essential. They are a fabrication of a mind fooled into thinking there is a relation. Because if the monadic pluralism is true, then every being is itself utterly isolated from every other being. There is no communication. If you speak and I listen, or I speak and you listen, if we think there's any relation between the thing said and the thing heard, that would be totally an illusion. There is none. Now that doesn't bear examination at all, because if you did, we'd all get up and walk away immediately, and I would be first out through the door. Now let's think about the word one and the doctrine of monism. The doctrine of monism says there is only one ultimate power. And when we write the word one in any of the languages we know, any of the words you can use to translate the word one, the implication is always that there is a circumscription around it. So if we say universe, uni means one, universe, one term. Make a great big circle, and you include all phenomena inside that big circle. Now, if you can include it inside the big circle, so that nothing is left out, you can talk about a monism. But when you draw a circle, don't you, in the act of drawing it, exclude the infinite? You've contained within the circle, within the sphere, what there is, but you have excluded infinity. In the act of drawing that line, you've made a funny kind of disguised dualism. The one sphere of the universe has excluded an infinity of other possibilities not mentioned. Now, to avoid this difficulty, another term was coined, non-dualism. Now, non-dualism says that dualism is untrue, but it also says that monism is a false idea. Because to make monism, you have to draw a line round total reality. And that line excludes infinity beyond it. So let's rub out the dualism and rub out the monism and see what we have instead. And call this non-dualism. Advaita. Not two-ness. What have we got then? We have an infinite field with no circumscribing line on it, and this infinite field has internal to it all the things that we can draw some circumscribing lines on. This infinite field covers whatever we care to think about, and yet transcends anything whatever that we can say about it. So if I say, well, the origin of the universe gives evidence that there is a power that has made the universe the great big one turn, but beyond this turn there is that which is not turning, that is the motionless mover, the one that doesn't move itself but moves the universe, the one turner within itself. And that these are not really two, because the big sphere of the universe is nothing but a modal expression of the infinite. Now, is that a fairly simple concept? We have an infinite power, And the infinite power posits the universe and every being within it, and everything we can draw a line round, it posits these, but itself has not got a line round it. Now the man who was burned at the stake for saying that very clearly was Bruno in the year 1600, because he said the centre of infinity is anywhere, like each person here is the centre of awareness, and the perimeter, the periphery, is nowhere. There is no outer circle binding us all. It's infinite. But each one of us is a centre within the infinite, posited by the infinite, and mysteriously there is no dualism. It posits within itself, like a dot for each being, within a field. We can represent the field by a piece of plain paper, and we can get a pencil and put dots on the paper and say, each dot represents an individual, and each individual is not separate from the power which is infinite, which posits the dot. We then have a non-dualistic, non-monistic, infinite source power of all things. Now, let's take another step. We have said that we can't have an ultimate dualism because totally alien things cannot interact. Now let's take two very alien things according to science, namely consciousness of the scientist and the object on the table in the laboratory. We have consciousness and we have objects of consciousness. And it would appear that these two, the object of consciousness, like this chair, and the consciousness which is aware of the chair, are not of the same order. Don't you treat your body, especially your bones, as if they were objective realities, in some way mysteriously absolutely different from your consciousness of the bones? Don't you feel, if you knock one bone on another in that way, that somehow the hardness of the bone is not like the subtlety of your will, the subtlety of your wishes, your wants, your desires? Somehow wishes and wants and desires and wills are not the same as physicality, as physical bodiness. But our impossibility of accepting a dualism says that we cannot have two utterly different ultimates, because they couldn't interact. Now, it is a fact that in the human body, from our own personal experience, and from the animals and the plants and so on, that there is a relationship between willing, desiring, wishing, wanting, and movement of the body. I wish to wave my hand at my friend over there, John Coop. Hello, John. And he waved back. That's a sign of communication. He understood what I meant by wave, and when I went like this, he didn't think I'd suddenly gone funny. He thought I was waving. Something happened inside him, and in his consciousness he made an interpretation, and then he demonstrated it by waving his hand back. Did I ask you to wave your hand back, John?
No.
Did we meet before this meeting and arrange that I would wave my hand and you would respond? No?
No.
Right, so we didn't connive, and yet we mysteriously interpreted each other. Now, there is therefore a non-dualistic relationship between the will, the desire, the wish, the want, and the movement of physical muscles and bones. The muscles and the bones are moved by an intent of the will, or by the desire, or by the wish, or the want. There is a wish, a want, a desire, and suddenly an arm waves. There is a manifest relation between them. And we can't allow a dualism, so we have to say there must be a causative interrelation between the waving of the hand and the will to wave it. And the moment we've allowed this, we've stepped into very strange country, which is purely creative. Because if this is so, and it is unavoidably, undeniably so, then the will, the desire, the wish, the want, can influence the so-called material world. Now let's hold that in our mind a bit. We're now going to examine the concept of an infinite continuum. Infinite means not bound, infinite, not limited. And continuum. Continuum is used to express the idea of that which is passless, that which is not made of little bits like atoms, is a field of power, a field of power, with no gaps, no interspaces, no voidages. The whole of reality is an infinite field of power. If it had parts, there would be gaps between them, and if the gap were utterly dissimilar from the objective part within the space, there would be a dualism again, and we can't allow a dualism. A dualism is false, it's bad logic. So we have to say this, that the object is a modality of the continuum. The pathless continuum, not made of atoms, a continuous field of power by its self-modalizations, self-compressions, and so forth, creates what we call the objective world. Now in this way, the objective world is not other than the continuum behaving locally like an object, and there is no dualism. Now let's look at this very carefully. We said we cannot avoid the conclusion that a dualism is false. We cannot avoid that a desire, a wish, a want can move a muscle, change the position of a bone. And in the process of admitting that, adding that to the continuum, we have to say, because the continuum has no parts, therefore the quality of the continuum is throughout its whole infinity everywhere identical. That means to say that if a finger can go like that there, a finger can go like that there, and a leg can go like that there, the continuum's qualities are throughout identical. Now that is the equivalent of saying the universe is entirely magical, because there is no fundamental difference between willing, desiring, wishing, wanting, and matter, body. We have to see that so-called bodies are objectifications by self-activation, self-modalizings of an infinite continuum. But the qualities in the continuum are throughout themselves identical everywhere. And we've already said that desire and will and wishing and wanting and physical bodies moved by desire cannot ultimately be different. So that both desires and physical bodies must be both modalities of that continuum. Now, let's look at the idea of the continuum as possessed of all conceivable qualities, because any quality that we have can be discovered anywhere within the infinite space that we call the place of the universe and beyond. You know, in physics you say the chemistry of all parts of space is the same. And if you were an atomist, you might say it's all built of hydrogen, because hydrogen has one electron, one proton, and you just keep adding these up and you get further elements until you get to uranium and some artificial ones beyond. But they're all simply the adding up of one and one and one and one and one and one and one. So that all numbers other than one are shorthand for a long expression like 1, 1 equals 2, 1, 1, 1 equals 3, 1, 1, 1, 1 equals 4. It is quicker to say 1, 2, 3, 4 than to keep muttering 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. And as Carol would say, I lost count. The thing about counting and making special names for special groups of ones is that it's economic. It saves time. Now we have a continuum which is infinite, and we have the qualities of that continuum, everywhere identical, and we have those qualities observable in two ways, as consciousness and as objective content of consciousness. And when we identify our consciousness, we discover that the consciousness itself is infinite. Because when you look at a person, you know, there's my friend Josie, and I recognize her, and behind is Pamela and Gordon and so on. When I look at them, at the very moment of focusing on Josie, I see a space around her, and occupying that space that is Pamela and that is Gordon and so on. Each of the times that I look at an object, I become aware of the space beyond it. My awareness is always beyond the object. The object is always internal to my field of awareness. But we can't have two infinites, can we? Infinites have no edges. So if we had two, they'd be mutually interpenetrating and absolutely indistinguishable. So now we arrive at a curious thing. An infinite field of power with the capacity to project inside itself, introject, throw inside itself, objective manifestations of itself as power. And these objective manifestations are what we call bodies in this infinite field. But we also have a quality, also of the same continuum, of the awareness of these objectifications. And we're not allowed to dualism, so we have to say a very peculiar thing. The infinite continuum has a dual aspect, but not an ultimate dual reality. And the dual aspect is body impression, body introjection, and awareness of body, producing apparently two worlds, a world of awareness and a world of objective contents of the field of awareness. And this gave rise, anciently, to the idea of souls and bodies. The soul being the field of awareness, and the body being the introjected condition of manifestation of the soul. In modern parlance, we call that psychosomatic correspondence. For every psychic condition, there is a precipitate that becomes a so-called objective chemical representation of that psychological internal self-precipitation. Now, because it is conscious, because it is sentient, it is aware of its content. Because it is power, it can mobilize its objectified content. And we cannot separate the consciousness and the power other than aspectually by an intellectual fiction. Therefore, we have to say this continuum of sentient power must know absolutely all its contents as we know the contents of our world, only to an infinitely extended degree. We have to say that that continuum, that field of power, is a field of consciousness, a field of sentience, with the totality of all conceivable objects within it, introjected by it and known by it absolutely to the minutest detail. There is no object that is not known to the field that precipitates the object. Now let's think about this continuum of sentient power and then say to ourselves, when we talk about personality in ourselves, what do we mean? We always mean, well, I know I can think, I know I can feel, I know I can will and express myself. And if we have these faculties, we say that is a person. A person, persona, through sounding, through this organism, sounds an intention. It uses some ragged vocal cords to express itself, but it is expressing an intention. My intention to think and then to express my thought are not ultimately separable. They are all of the modalities of the field of power. And this continuum, this field of sentient power in us has personality. But this personality that we are so fond of and so fond of shining with and so proud of when we think it's a good shiny one, this person, this personal expression, this personality of man, which we all admit and proudly state that we have, is nothing but a modality of the infinite sentient field power. And this infinite sentient field power has all the personalities that we've got, whereas we generally only have the little bit we have. When we talk about reflexively getting hold of ourselves, that is becoming aware that we think and feel and will, and that we will to feel and will to think, we are saying of ourselves we have a marvellous power. I will recite Mary Had a Little Lamb and 3, 2, 1, 0 deliberately, and we can all do the same thing, can't we? Yes, we can. This modalizing of the infinite power of the universe in each of us is nothing but an act of that infinite continuum of the field power, nothing but an act of that field power, and that field power cannot not know what we are doing. In fact, close my fist like that, and I know it. Do you know I've closed my fist? Do you know I've opened it? Do you know I've closed it? Opened it? Well then, the continuum of field power must know that I am closing my fist when I close it. It cannot not know it. And what I call my personality, your personalities, our power to think and feel and will and express ourselves, that is a modality of that field power. Now take all the things that all the beings that have ever lived in the past, all the things of all the beings living in the present, and all the things of all the beings that ever can live in the future, which have this mysterious capacity of personal self-expression, put it all together in one magnificent, marvellous view. There is nothing that it does not know, has not known, is knowing now, and will know in what we in our finite minds call the future. Because the future also is a modality of that same sentient field power. So we have been able to say this field power somehow mysteriously must be not only all power, omnipotence, it must be omniscience also. It knows everything, down to our least breath, our minutest itch. This field power has all that we mean by personality, plus lots of things we haven't yet learned in physical science. And the total wisdom that the human race will eventually arrive at will be no more than the interjected self-impression of that infinite field power. So that all our personal expressions are really nothing but the personal expression of this infinite field power. And then instead of keep repeating that long term, infinite, omnipresent, omniscient, omnipotent, intelligent, self-determinant power, for economy only we'll say God. But when we say God, we will not mean a funny old man on a cloud. We will always mean the totality of all that we could possibly think of in every way, physically, emotionally, mentationally, conceptually, volitionally, episcopally. All of those, plus many, many things that we haven't evolved yet to be smart enough to conceive, and all of these together are God. Now we have to define sin. Whenever we introduce a new word, we must define it. Now the word sin is a translation of a Greek word meaning to miss the mark. And the word sin also, in the Anglo-Saxon Germanic root, means to aim, to have a goal. If your goal is finite, you're a sinner. Why so? Because when you have a finite goal, you have elected to say, I will do X, and I define it. In the act of defining it, it becomes finite. how do I know that the infinite will disallow it or allow it? Is it within the capacity of an individual egotistic human being to declare his aim and say, I will fulfill it, like I'll do the highest pole vault that ever was at the next Olympics, and some comedian throws a bar of soap in the bath unexpectedly, I skid and hit the back of my skull on the bath and it cracks, and I've now got a dream of the Olympics. Not the fact. Everything we do finitely and will to do finitely can be contradicted by the infinite sentient feel power, the shorthand for which he's got. So we sin when we very foolishly think we have an aim which is finite, defined by us, and at the same time believe how we come to it. I don't know. I've never been able to believe it, but I've been assured by thousands of people that they believe it, that they can actually define a target and go for it and guarantee to get it, barring earthquakes and what the insurance companies call acts of God, which the policy doesn't cover. Yes? Covers all of us? All objects. Yes, object. Object is short for an orb thrown. Ob and orb is the same word. And jet means to throw, doesn't it? I know you've done a bit of Latin. You know, the orb thrown, yes, is the object. Who threw it? The infinite sentient field power threw the object inside, and in being thrown, it became THR1, didn't it? It's not only thrown, 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 let us say, owed to the absolute. It is also a throne upon which you can sit. It's an objective position. The earth is a throne object. It is God's footstool. That is to say, the infinite has posited that earth to stand on and to live on. There are no objects that are not modalities of that infinite sentient power field. All of them are introjections, inthrowings of that field. And we have no possibility of escape. Now, we can then look at the human race and divide it historically into two kinds of beings. Those that like the idea that there is an intelligent, sentient field power creating, maintaining the universe and looking after its creation, and those who hate the idea of it because it's an interference with their private aims, the Herods of this world, the ones who would like to corner the market, the ones who would like to buy all the shares of Amazon first day of sale, the ones who would like to get a bigger and a better of whatever it is than anybody else and make it absolutely secure. Two kinds of people. Those that are very pleased to think that the universe is fundamentally intelligent with a caring, considering, personalized power in charge, and those that don't want that personal power to be in charge because it could interfere with the stock exchange at the moment I'm about to buy. So we divide those into two kinds of people, and they're called in occult terms people of the right-hand power, those who like the idea of intelligence being in charge; people of the left-hand power, those who dislike it and wish to wriggle out of it. Now, any argument you care to present, in any way whatever, for the freedom of the individual human being determining his own act, his own belief, his own desire, his own will, his own purpose. Any argument you care to put forward to prove that and establish it as a truth, I will personally undertake to take to pieces. Now, will anybody care to advance any kind of justification whatever for this statement? Let someone say, I believe that I, personally, finitely, within this physical body, with my brains, my nervous system, my heart, my liver, my spleen, my kidneys, that all my work, and I can do with them as I will, and there is no interference from the infinite sentient power, which, according to Karl Marx, is opium for the masses. But even Karl Marx, in the same passage, said, not only opium, but a cry of the human heart against the tyranny of this materialism. Now, is anybody going to stick a neck out and undertake to defend?
The I, absolutely, self, the conscious observer, absolutely,
see yourself
as actually
being that self. You see yourself? Are you talking about Gordon
Smith? No.
No, who?
The
infinite. The infinite observer. Then that's not Gordon Smith. Gordon Smith is the name of a modality of it in that place. Can that particular modality, which we call the empirical ego, guarantee to fulfill any of its purposes whatever?
Definitely not.
Is there anybody that thinks that they could? Is there anybody here to whom I can bend the knee and say, verily thou hast spoken the truth, and as from now I don't believe in that other infinite center, I believe in you? Yeah? The Yiddish half of my soul would revolt and say, that sounds suspiciously like idolatry. Yeah? Krishnamurti has spent 50 years trying to convince people that he's not a divine messiah. He doesn't understand why they persist in believing it. Well, it says believing in the other one, doesn't it? It's an economy. Well, you see, he's talking like a non-dualist, isn't he? Now, supposing we say, okay, you've done very well in your life since 1928 as a messiah that denies he's a messiah, and we're now going to jump on you and smash you to pieces physically. And we know that your consciousness will observe the smashing of the bones and the pouring out of the blood. Are you ready to receive it? What he said to Bernard Levin was, I have a fine sense of danger. You make that kind of remark. If you look like the kind of fellow that would fulfill it, I think I'm going to retire from the studio. Like Nureyev, when the interview is over, he doesn't wait to participate in the next interview, does he? No, he vacates his chair. He is top cat. How could he sit next to Jimmy Tarbuck? Yeah. Now, the empirical ego has been specially built in the time process by civilization to keep civilization going. Now, we have a long line of men, prophets, sages, philosophers, thinkers, who have occupied themselves, to our written knowledge, for about 6,000 years. And for how long before that is open to speculation. And they all come up with the same conclusion, which the individual empirical egotistically centered people don't like. There is sentient power. It does know that it is. And it's more personal than we are, because it includes all our persons, as we individually include all the cells in our body. In your blood you have swimming about some little phagocytes. They go about swimming in the stream of your blood, and when they see a bacterium that might upset you, they eat it. Sometimes they eat too many and die, and they are heard to mutter, well, it's sacrificed for the good of the whole, as they die. Do they? Have we any electromagnetic records of the phagocyte dying, shouting, oh, I've just died of a surfeit of horrible bacteria in order that Gordon Smith might live? Or are they ignorant of your existence? When they're swimming, chasing the bacteria in your blood, do they say, I'm swimming for Gordon? Or do they say, I'm swimming for dinner? Yes. Now, all living beings are modalities of that infinite sentient field of power, without any exceptions. And they're all in the position of the little phagocyte in your blood. They don't know any more about the existence of that superpower, that infinite intelligence, than a phagocyte knows about an individual human being in whose blood system it is swimming about. And what happens to the games of egotism if that is so? You're about to do a naughty deed, and you remember the prophets have said, God has said, that is that infinite sending power of which you are a modality. Certain things are permissible and certain not. And if you do one that is not allowed, I don't mind. But I've arranged for you to be met at the corner of the street with a 9-foot-high mugger armed with a heavy bicycle chain studded with diamonds and razor blades. And I have arranged it. I don't mind you acting freely, but you must allow me also to be free to respond. And the way I turn the other cheek, says this absolute, is quite simply I turn somebody else's cheek. Another of my creatures is a mad Irishman who wants to go for a fight. And he feels, I think I'll go down to the Rembrandt tonight. There's an easy punch up there. The place is full of queers. They don't fight very well. I'll go down there and beat them up. And so he goes. And the field of which he is an objectification says, this is a marvellous opportunity for educating naughty Irishmen that beat up gentle intersex people. And he arranges, as on one occasion in my personal experience, what was it? 6 feet 6 of Negro homosexuality with muscles. You see? Oh. You see, do you know that can happen? I had quite a number of homo friends during the war who were commandos. Did you know that? Can you imagine a gentle homo commando leaping out, boing, crashing to the ground, and he's full of muscles? So you know, you don't have to be muscleless to be queer. Really not. You can be highly intelligent, very, very gentle, and bear a bigger muscle like my brother Sylvester. The bigger all the muscle on the chest. You see, and the field is in charge. And there's a lot of people that don't like it. They really don't. There are people that beat hell out of a horse to make it jump. And those of you who watch show jumping will probably have somebody come to mind almost immediately. It's obvious I don't mean David Groom, do I? No. There's another one far worse than that. Well, somebody takes a sentient piece of living material and something like that to make it do something it's not supposed to do. A horse naturally is a plains animal, but I'm going to turn this plains animal into a stick jumper over her if I have to kick the hell out of it. There are such people. It's funny, isn't it? We can account for them by saying, well, they were misunderstood as babies. But we're pulling our own legs, because the essential is this: the continuum of sentient power is throughout itself identical in all its qualities, and one of its qualities is free will. And that's a very weird thing. That means that every single individual introjection, every living being, every human being, has a capacity for freely doing wrong as well as right. Because one of the qualities of the continuum, which is everywhere the same, is initiative. We have a power, which we know very well, the ability to ignore rationality, to ignore thought. We have a power, which we've all got, and know we have, to ignore truth that's inconvenient, don't we? And when we do ignore it, the universal power and the infinite beyond the universal says, okay, this is very interesting. You're going on a prodigal course. I won't stop you. I will let you use your initiative. In Islam it says God gives you your will to use as if it is your own. And when you use it, the punchback that comes to you is the natural logical result of your misconceived private empirical egotistic plan. There is no escape. And there are some people in the philosophical systems that have tried to wriggle out of that divine intelligence, so they invented another concept, for instance, Buddhism. Now in Buddhism there is no God. But the God that Buddha was saying there is not one of was the God of the Hindu pantheon that was defined in such a way, finitely, that it couldn't possibly be the infinite. So when Buddha said there is no God, he meant that the reality of those Hindu particular gods in the temples was not ultimate. It was only a modality of the infinite. And so, you say, there is no God, but there is something else in the place of that God. And that is a law of cause and effect. And this cause is the ultimate power. And this effect is this universe of phenomena. And every phenomenon is itself pursuing a cause, karma, driven by desire, kamma, cupidity, and having to pay the price of its own directives. Now apparently it's got rid of God, but the God it got rid of was a pseudo-God, not a true, absolute, infinite God, because Buddha believed in infinity and believed it was a very good aim to attain to. But the particularized gods worshipped in the various temples were not ultimate and therefore not truly God. Get rid of those and substitute for it the law of cause and effect. Jesus, a very astute Jewish thinker, said, well, what's it saying except this? As you sow, so you reap. If you do a certain act, there will be a comeback from that field of power, which is infinite. You cannot calculate the results. You behave in a polite way to so-and-so because he has connections. You behave in an impolite way to this man because he has no connections. And then you discover that the man with no connections is actually the secret boyfriend of a married lady of terribly great influence with the man who has influence. Your calculation was wrong. And as a finite, empirically centered being, you cannot control the infinity of data that is available to the infinite. So in fact it means we are literally at the mercy of an infinite field of sentient power which knows what we are because we are its modifications. We are its modalities. We are its impressions. And it is in charge of our behavior, our thought, our feeling, our will, and it allows us to operate in any way we care to, and then responds to our mode of expression with its own type of response, which we, as empirical egoic beings, cannot anticipate and not control. If you believe in the Lord, then you are afraid of the law governing the universe, the law of comeback. Law would only mean principle of binding order. Yeah? Easily. I mean, how do you decide whether you will go to a concert or not a concert, which you haven't been to before? You see an ad in the underground, world famous, this, that, or the other, about to appear in the Albert Hall. How do you decide whether to go or not when you haven't seen him? Answer: curiosity. One of the qualities of the infinite sentient power is curiosity. It's a nice word, curiosity. It's from curios, Lord. It means, if I go, will I become a top cat? If I don't go, will my friends say, you didn't go to the concert, it was brilliant, and you missed it. But if I go, I see a man playing with six fingers. I saw him pass. I got to my pens. I haven't been. And you just drop a casual reference to the six-fingered wonder. And I say, oh, what's that? Oh, there's a chap I met. Actually, I went backstage in the dressing room. I shook hands with these six fingers. And this is called curiosity. Curios, the Lord. How to become a top cat? How do you choose? The answer is always the same. I choose to be a top cat. And in every situation, I think, does this go to top cat or on that one? And the ultimate top cat is that mysterious being called God, who we hope doesn't exist. But the infinite sentient power does exist. He exists, that it stands out, in all his interjections. All the creatures that he has made are him, self-existent, self-expressed. And that means, as Jesus said, is it not written, ye are gods? You are creative impression expressions of the infinite sentient power. There is nothing you can't do except defeat that infinite sentient power. You have full permission to do anything you wish, and you have full certainty of receiving your reward. How do you choose, Peter? In the past, how have you chosen where to go tonight? Curiosity. Why? It's simple. We don't know everything yet. And we'd like to know everything, wouldn't we? And that desire to know everything is a desire to usurp the position of the infinite sentient power field. If you read in Genesis 49, you will find a description of the sons of Jacob made by their father, and he talks about Reuben, my firstborn. He lusted after his father's bed, wherefore he shall not excel. His very firstborn son wishes to be bigger than his daddy. Now there's a certain illogicality about that, which Kierkegaard refers to when he says, as against the father, the son is always in the wrong. Because the inheritance that the son has from the father is the means whereby the son can oppose the father. So he's even indebted to the father for his capacity to revolt. He cannot get rid of his eternal debt. Like Satan says in Paradise Lost, how terrible. I am faced with the infinite, horrible, eternal fact that I am a creature indebted to the Creator. And I can't get rid of my debt. I can pay it every day, saying praise, singing hymns, trying to quieten it. But the fact is, I am a creature, and I cannot displace the Creator, not ever. So what is his solution? He says, I've only got to go up one step. I'm the brightest of all the angels. So I'm only one step down from the infinite absolute. So just one step. How big is the step? I'll have a go, he says. I'll take the step up. Bang, Michael comes along. Who is like unto God? And Satan goes, bang. Lucifer has now become Satan. He's down below, empirical ego, sitting there now. Funny that I was up there, only one step to go. And now I've got a lot of steps to go. Now he's very positive because he's eternal, because one of the qualities of the infinite sentient power continuum is that it is eternal. Therefore, all its modalities participate in eternality. So Satan says, well, you can't get rid of me, I'm eternal, I'm part of him. Now what I can do to get my own back, having been thrown out and kicked and made lots of steps to the top, I have heard via Cheshire Bush Telegraph that God, who threw me out, has set up another creature called man. Mankind, Adam, in my place. Well, he's a creature, so he must be weak. If I, the brightest, was very, very weak, compared to the infinite, think how much weaker is the thing that's made medially between the absolute infinite up there and the hellish locked up Satan down here. There's a fellow only there. He can't be very smart. That's mankind. I won't have his direct tilt to God again. He's a bit powerful. He says to Job, "Hast thou an arm like mine?" And Job looks at it and says, "Not really, sir." And Satan says, "I will knock man. I'm not that stupid. I've had one good hiding. I will now have a go at man." So he disguises himself as a phallic symbol, let us say a serpent, and he goes charmingly not to the man but to the woman. And he says to the woman, "I have a secret way of getting pleasures. And God has told you not to eat of a certain tree's fruit. But if you do, you really enjoy yourself." And she is deceived because she is pleasure bound. And suddenly, the created creature, man, is thrown out of the garden of protected Eden into the world of time, into the world of empirical experience, into the world of egotism, into the world of suffering, where there were previously fruit trees, beautiful grasses with seeds to make corn, etc. Now there are thistles and horrible craggy stones. Man is in the time process because the thrown down Luciferian figure becomes satanic, has said to man, "You too can have a go at usurping God. I can't persuade God to do it, but I can persuade you because you're only a creature." And so man is on his process of having been demoted from the Edenic, that is non-judgment state, thrown into the world of time, and he now has to go along making empirical judgments. Now he can't see properly. He makes himself a skin. He hides. You know, the word hide is from hide. This stuff. That's hide. We are hiding inside the skin. But we're really infinite. Dr. Jekyll, Jekyll means God, affirmation of God. Hyde means the dark, unconscious, satanic, down-thrown, on its way to revenge itself. Everybody has a Hyde in him, and everybody has a Jekyll in him. And the Jekyll says, "I'm a very good fellow doing good healing people." And the Hyde in him says, "What on earth for? What kudos do I get out of helping people? I'm a grateful lot of swine. I'm a GP. Do you know what I do? I look at all the drug brochures, 1.5 hundred weights per annum. I read them all. I try to find out what's good for my patient. And what does my patient do when I give it a handful of tablets I haven't personally tried? Throws them down the loo, the grateful creature. Why bother? Don't read the brochures. Just say, try these. And then you look at a list called side effects, supplied by the same drug houses. Now, what did I give him last time? Does it mix with this one? Well, I'm thinking actually about waving a check when I come back from my holidays. Yeah? For having been away. Not for having been at work. Because we have a welfare state. And in the welfare state, everybody is taken care of by the government. And if the government does that, it stays in the position of government. And we don't have a military coup, and we don't have an insurrection, and we don't have a revolution. And that's marvellous, that's comfortable. And then, the empirical ego, because its curiosity is infinite, and its possessions are finite, wants to modify the system. As long as there is relative ignorance, there will be a continuance of curiosity and the pursuit of further knowledge and further power. But whether we get that power depends on the infinite continuum of sentient power of which we are modalities only. The ring is the egotistic concept. If you think you're finite, and you think you can pursue a finite course, and by cunning and manipulations and willfulness and misrepresentation and deceit. If you think you can get somewhere by that technique, you've got a ring round it, the ring of the egotistic definition, called the ring past not. Until you break that egotism, you cannot conceive yourself to be merely a modality of an ocean of sentient power. And when you know that you're a modality, you say, instead of I will, you say let there be that which is most appropriate. So running through Islam, you have the statement about the wise man who has reached a level and he says, be and it is. But the empirical ego cannot do that. The empirical ego is time bound, committed to investigate phenomena in the hope of accumulating sufficient knowledge to outflank the absolute. And it's an illogical essay. How do we feel about it if we accept for a moment that our very body has been precipitated, and the bodies of our ancestors, from the infinite over millions of years, and brought to its present condition of human reflexive awareness, not by its empirical egotistic efforts, but by the all-overruling will to create reflexive beings who will know that they are not different ultimately from God? How does it feel? And as one fellow said to me last week, I don't like the idea, it's a bit too loaded with responsibilities. If that is true, am I permitted to do dirty tricks? Am I permitted to twist, to disorder, to misrepresent, to fool my friends, to gain an advantage ever higher and higher, and eventually crush him into the ground? And then when I'm quite sure he's nearly dead, and well weighted down with chains round the ankles, out of pure mercy I give him a drink of water. And then hope to slip into acceptance by the absolute at the last moment. And yet mysteriously their whole behaviour is permitted by the infinite sentient power which is God. Now why does God permit it? You know why? You're a good chooser, Peter, why? Why does God allow fantastically terrible things manifesting? There's a people in Somalia. The little babies are tummy swollen with gas and no food. And there are people collecting monies and goods and clothes for those kiddies and for the starving. And it doesn't get there. Much of the help that's given never arrives. Why is it permitted? Because it could be stopped. Why does that infinite sentient power permit it? What's the key sentence that tells you why? Thus it becomes to fulfill all righteousness. Now think very carefully. If that infinite power, sentient power, all-knowing source of this universe of ours and of us, if that power is omniscient, he must know everything. Now, is it possible to know anything thoroughly without actualizing it? Not possible, is it? So mustn't there be, in order to fulfill all knowledge and actualization of every conceivable crime, and then we can see it. You know, William Blake thought about that. Thought it was very good. He felt the body was a very good invention for this simple reason. Before you had a body, when you were a pure spirit, you were translucent, and so were all the other spirits, and you couldn't see anything to object to complain about. And then by interjection, by condensation of power, bodies were made, and they manifested in concrete, solid reality every conceivable kind. And then, says William Blake, then you can choose what you don't like. It's objectified. If you say to a little boy, who's banging about because he doesn't know any better. He may be 2 years of age. And he's not yet been thumped very hard, but he's busy hitting his mother and his father and visitors and so on. And if you use a few words like, you are aware of the Brahmanical doctrine of karma, are you? What does the little boy say? Totally meaningless words, so you get another bang on the nose. What does the bang on the nose mean? It means reverberalize your position a bit more clearly. Yeah? That's what the little boy's behavior is for. William Blake saw this with great clarity. The objective world is there so that you can really choose, because you see demonstrably before your eyes in 3D concrete what is useless. And that's a failure. Let's take top category. Top category, top doggery. Girls and boys. Cats for girls and dogs for boys. Now, everybody knows, like Samuel Butler said, every human being has trouble because he wants to be 3 inches taller than every other human being. And that's impossible. Now, every person with a top cat, top dog intention makes very sure they're not going to think about the impossibility of it. And if they do, they won't try it. I'm going to try to deceive you, Margaret. Yeah? I'm going to tell you a lie. I'm going to try to persuade you to believe it. Have I got that power? Or are you already suspicious? I should have kept my mouth shut. Supposing I learn the lesson, I'm not going to tell you I'm going to deceive you. I'm going to creep up on you surreptitiously, without a word. I'm going to start stroking your little toe. Do you remember the advice given to Ruth about how to seduce Boaz? What the mother said. Mothers always know these things. Start at the bottom of the bed, working on the big toe. You know there's a nerve connection from the big toe through to a gland in your head, and from there to there. So if you creep to the bottom of somebody's bed and it's got a male in it, and you put your hand under the blanket and feel for the big toe, like one of those blood-sucking bats of South America. And you're very quietly going, and the toe goes, and the message goes. What happens? The toe withdraws. You follow it. The toe withdraws. You follow it. Suddenly you're in bed. And the king's crown is a bit awry. But the toe feels pleasantly interesting. Suddenly you got yourself a husband. Start with the big toe. I could have done. I'm giving the game away again. I can't even start on your big toe now. Can I start somewhere else? I can. I can start in the field. Can you feel the field? Don't think I posit my intention in the field. I don't tell you what it is. I'm not starting with your physical body, no? Physical body. Emotions, mentations, conceptions, volitions, episcopal overlookings, and the infinite field. I've got my intention in the field, and I'm not verbally defining it, and I'm not formulating it yet, but I'm closing in on you like this. And you know how you catch an ordinary fly? You know, a fly can only feel when to get out of the way. If you move your hand too quickly, it feels a buffeting of the air and flies away. So if you move your hand very slowly, like this, cup it, move it very slowly, giving your air in your hand time to flow gently around the hand. You can go like that. And you can close your fingers around that fly, like that. The fly. By infinitely gentle, slow enclosing. How do you like that? Now, has the empirical ego any defense against it? No. when we are in exactly that position in relation to the infinite field power which is God. He does this. And then appears this ideal system of stars. He goes like that, and then there's a solar system. He goes like that, there's a planetary system. He goes like that, there's the earth. He goes like that, there's plants, animals, men. And all surreptitiously over millions of years, we don't feel it, and we're here. Isn't that terrible? We're so used to it, we don't feel it. Constant, uniform stimulation is equivalent to no stimulation. And we have been in the grip of that infinite sentient field power from before the foundation of the universe. And it's going like that on us. And there's no escape. And we're so used to this continuously gentle pressure, we can't feel it. But I'm going to ask you something. When you sit still, very quietly, as still as you can, don't you feel that you're buzzing a bit? Can you feel it? You know, heat is work and work is heat, isn't it? Thermodynamic law. And you're alive and therefore at work. If you listen, you can hear. You can hear nervous impulses bashing about in your brain. If you focus on any part of your body, you will feel it buzzing with life. But normally during the daytime, do you feel it like that? Or are you so busy, extroverted, on your objective, empirical, egoic intent that you don't feel it like that? Normally you don't. No, I would say averagely you don't. Normally you do. If you're really normal, you do feel it. You sit down. How am I doing? Hey, hey. In relation to the Absolute, I feel the Absolute intent holding me in being. And then one day, over my left shoulder, the morning voice, the Absolute just stopped pressing quite so hard. Uh-oh, death stands in my left shoulder. Left shoulder, because that's the ancestral memory side where all the memories of all the deaths of all ancestors have been recorded. Oh, death's coming. The power that was doing that on me is now doing this on me. I'm going to fall apart, whether I like it or not. It's funny that they repeat that very often in Islamic religious literature, whether you like it or not. It's a lovely little saying. Just think, we're being held in being by an infinite sentient power, and when it decides to, instead of going like that, it goes like that, and we feel faint, and we have twinges, and we lose bone density, and our organs fall apart, and we rush off, and we get cortisone, and we get this, that, and the other, and pump it in. All we get for those is side effects. This is happening. And yes, you could say to that power that's doing that, Lord, can I do something for you a little bit longer, please? I've been thinking somehow of a useful thing that will keep me in time a little bit longer, please, Lord. And you mean it, you know. Are you serious? Yeah, I've got a good idea, a very great service to your evolutionary purpose. And where does the idea come from, says he? You, Lord, of course. And so, like my friend Mr. Abbott, who taught all his Baptist pupils that the lifespan of man is 70 years, 3 score and 10. Poetic form, he doesn't say 3 score and 10, actually. And at 81, his disciples came to him. Oh, Mr. Abbott, you said the Bible is full of truth, and you said the Bible said 3 score years and 10. Why are you 81? He said, without hesitation, extra time for good behavior. Now, let's go away a little bit and think about it. And ask ourselves, which side of the fence are we on, the right or the left? Do we like the idea of an intelligent, directive, cooperative infinite sentient power, God personal, or do we dislike the idea of a personal overlooking power? And if we dislike it, we're on the left-hand path, and if we like it, we're on the right-hand path. And Jesus says about that, call those sheep and those goats. And then at the end, you do that with them. The ones on the left go on the right, and the ones on the right go on the left. Does he eliminate the ones who were on the left, or does he put them on the right? All the ones on the left are prodigal sons. All the ones on the right could have been believing to save trouble. Shall we now retire a little and think about it?